Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the next 30 minutes. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is author Corey Washington. Corey has just published a really, really interesting book, Plain Talk. Good morning, Corey, and welcome to the show.
Good evening. Good morning. I always wanted to do that.
Hello, good evening, and welcome. That's my best Frost impression. He was a journalist in England.
Right.
Can we start with a little background? Who is Corey Washington?
Well, to put it simply, I'm a teacher right now. I teach in Augusta, Georgia. I'm a sixth grade social studies teacher, and I enjoy teaching. Before that, I went to college for actually agribusiness, but I didn't like that, so I got into teaching. Was working with the government at the Department of Agriculture. So, you know, I've kind of traveled around the East Coast a lot, but basically I'm, you know, got into writing kind of like as an inspiration to certain events.
I enjoy writing. I think writing is a great way to sort things out in your own mind, if you will. You know, seeing it on paper makes it easier to rationalize the problems, if you will.
Yes.
Plain Talk is aptly named. It deals with the very thorny subject of racism, and indeed the world is full of it. It's easy to find. What prompted you to write the book?
Well, if you remember the summer of this year, it seems like there was a flurry. Everybody knows about the election of Barack Obama, and everybody seemed to want to talk about race in that context, and every time something came up, it was always centered around race. Well, if you remember the Skip Gates or Henry Louis Gates incident with Officer Crowley in Cambridge, Massachusetts, near Boston, there was actually quite a discussion going on about that being a teachable moment, and now is the time to have a fresh discussion on race. And CNN had a program called Black in America, too, and it was just this big media blitz around this whole subject of race. And I just started thinking, you know, these same people all the time are on TV, on radio, or wherever, talking about race. I just said, well, they need some new fresh voices on this subject, or how is anything, you know, ever going to be accomplished?
Racism, as you point out in your book, is not an American problem. It's a global problem. I can think of no country, maybe with the exception of Iceland, that does not seem to foster some ill wind toward either another country or one of its own subcultures. Why does racism exist?
Well, it just seems like, you know, people, when they look at somebody that's different from them, they have a tendency to maybe not understand them. And one of the mechanisms that people have chosen is, when you don't understand, is to maybe denigrate them, and it just seems like the basis of it maybe can start from the color of one's skin, but then it branches off from cultural differences, because you travel all around, I'm sure you've said you're well-traveled, you can travel all around the world, and you can find people with different shades of skin, but at the same time, there are cultural differences. But no matter where you travel, whether it's Australia, whether it's England, whether it's the United States, you know, wherever, there seem to always be differences that are strongly based on the color of one's skin. And that was just an interesting aspect that I found in my research, but it just seemed like the total basis of it, the strongest basis, was the color of one's skin when it came to really riling people up.
Right, but skin, you know, as the saying goes, it's only skin deep. I personally think that the root is much more cultural than
right.
skin color. I mean, one only has to look at the hatred almost, but between India and Pakistan. I mean, you physically the two nations look the same, but they have very large cultural differences, and I suspect, you know, that's a much larger factor than just color. But, you know, color is the obvious starting point.
Right. It's the easiest thing for people to scapegoat. You know, like you say, the cultural differences is the real reason, but the thing that they use to pick at or to make slurs about is the color of one's skin. Because if you go in, even if you go to India, you have those Indians that are lighter skinned and those that are darker skinned that have the same culture. But, you know, there's even some, even with the caste system, some of the ones that are at the bottom actually just tend to have darker skin. And so there's different aspects that you can really think upon when it comes to this.
Oh, indeed. And in fact, you picked up on a very, very salient point. The lighter and Indian skin, the higher in the social structure he's perceived to be.
Right. Even with African Americans in this country, there was a big to-do about lighter-skinned African-Americans and darker-skinned African-Americans. And it just seemed like people were kind of developing something to try to separate people, because you have to be aware of agendas as well. It was this big thing where they would get into this discussion of back in slavery days, those who were lighter-skinned would be in the house with the master, those with darker skin would be out in the fields and so forth. And then people tried to put this in a modern-day context of saying lighter-skinned African-Americans get perks and darker-skinned African-Americans get treated badly. And it's like, I didn't see that myself until somebody brought this up. And so here it is, they're creating something that causes divisions, and we have to be aware of that as well.
Racism, to a large extent, is one of those subjects that we as a society tend to just sweep under the rug, look the other way. In some ways, it's almost a taboo subject. Did you receive any resistance from the publishing world when you proposed this book?
Well, when I first came up with the idea, I tossed around the idea of going to a big publisher with this, but once I found out how long it actually takes to put the book out, some 18 months, I kind of said, I think I might need to go with self-publishing on this one to get the message out a lot quicker, and then maybe go the route of, you know, getting a big publisher later. So that's my first thing. I didn't really go out into the publishing world and try to pitch this idea, but I knew I had a good idea. But from the people that I have pitched it to, it's all been positive. It's a very timely subject, you know, insightful. And so the only thing is the resistance would be from those people, like you said, that want to tend to not discuss race. I thought it would mainly be maybe just white people, but it's also black people as well, because on the white side you have those who may feel that they have a lot to lose, it makes them feel uncomfortable and so forth. But then on the African-American side, you have those who come to the conclusion that things are fine the way they are, they're getting better, don't stir the pot. And so you have it on both sides, so it's not just one race.
Right. I read a lot of books, and I've talked to hundreds of authors. I talk to publishers. I talk to agents. Talk to PR people, and the publishing industry is in what I consider to be a complete disarray. There's really three tiers to it. There's the there's the big publishing houses. Essentially, they're like the big record labels. Unless you have a top 10 hit, they won't even talk to you. The middle tier is the few remaining small independent publishers. They're without doubt my favorite, but they don't have huge amounts of resources, and once again, they tend to not really go for controversial books. There's one exception I can think of, and that would be Beaufort Books. Eric Kampman published very contentious If I Did It book that O.J. penned, and he also published The Jewel of Medina, which is a whole story unto itself. And then at the third tier is self-publishing, and quite honestly, if you're just starting out in the writing world, I think you'd be crazy to try either of the other tiers. I've heard stories about people sending out 200 letters, you know, spending 2 years and getting absolutely nowhere. So I think you chose wisely.
I would say so. Thoughts on that. Just in publishing this and getting the idea out there, I've just come to the conclusion that it seems things are backwards. For instance, you have those who are very rich and are celebrities. They can just put their name on a book. It could be garbage inside, and they would sell X number of copies. They would have, you know, carte blanche, so to speak. They would get all the publishing deals. They would get the book tours, and they would get all the hoopla around them. And that's the way the industry is set up now. Anybody that's a celebrity can pretty much be approached, and, hey, I want to write a book. And then, boom, they put their biography or, you know, it's, we can find their life story on the internet if we wanted to. But really insightful books, if you're just a regular person sitting at home, you have an idea, it's very hard, like you said, to get that idea out there. You have to work 100 times as hard as maybe a celebrity. So, and it's just, it just seems like it's just something to keep people down, so to speak, the way things are set up. And I realized that people come out with books every day. I was amazed at how many books actually come out through self-publishing. And it, a lot of people are complaining that it's flooding the market with inferior product. And so here it is, I have a good idea, but as soon as people hear the big-time people, the ABC, the CNNs, oh, you self-publish, they automatically assume that this is an inferior product when I never pitched it to a big house. This is not something that I pitched to someone that got rejected over and over and said, oh, I'm going to do self-publishing. I went straight to self-publishing, and this is my product, and it's a superior product, but I'm just a self-published author. I'm not inferior, and so I get that resistance a lot as well.
Yeah, the self-publishing tends to be a bit of a double-edged sword. You know, on the one hand, you can bring your book to market, but on the other hand, where's the market?
Right.
You know, the big houses essentially own the bricks and mortar bookstores. You know, they basically walk in, you know, Random House or whoever will walk in and say, "Here's the deal. You know, we've got these 20 books that we know are going to hit the New York Times bestseller list, and you need to stock them. And by the way, you also have to stock, note the word have to, have to stock, you know, these other 80 books or 200 books. Yeah, right. So, yeah, there's physically no shelf space left. You know?
Kind of like payola, remember that situation in the music industry?
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly what this is. It's a grossly unfair situation. And, I don't know what size town or city you live in, but I'll bet there aren't many independent bookstores where you are. You know, they've all gone the way of the dodo. You know, it's all Barnes and Noble these days.
We've got a couple that are kind of trying to flourish downtown. We have a new downtown scene in Augusta, Georgia that's kind of trying to, you know, be up and coming. And so there's about three down there that are really, you know, good. And so I can say that at least there are some of those here in Augusta. It's the second largest city in Georgia, so you would expect at least something, you know, like that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, on going back to what you said about celebrities and publishing books, I can guarantee that if Tiger Woods was to walk into any large publishing house, they would sign him up on the spot and write him a check for a couple of million.
Right.
I mean, it's grossly, grossly unfair. And truth be told, Tiger wouldn't actually write a single word of the book. The whole thing would be ghostwritten.
Right. This book, I've written every word in it, and it was slightly edited by the staff at Ex Libris, but for the most part, they left my writing style intact, and most of my words, there are very few changes. And so I just think that it also, society seems to reward bad behavior, because let's just say I went out there and crashed the gate at the White House or did something sensational. My books would fly off the market, but I'm not going to do that just to sell books. And yet you have these other people that will do things or say things in their book intentionally just to sell books, and we reward those people. And I think that's another shameful aspect of the publishing industry as well.
Oh, it is. Now, you are a teacher by trade. What do your colleagues and students think about Plain Talk?
Well, the initial reaction is one of congratulations. You know, you've written a book, and, you know, most of them have not really they don't know the details inside, but the ones that have actually brought the book, they've had positive reviews about it. I'm pretty sure there are some there at the school that may kind of, you know, not like the subject matter. Mm-hmm. But if they actually gave it a read, they would see that it's pretty even-handed. It's not, because, you know, the thing to think about when, let's say, a person of another race, they hear that an African-American has written a book on race. Oh, great. You know, here it is, this guy is going to be talking about white guilt and lambasting white people for being racist and so forth. That's the general idea. But when you read the book, it's very even-handed. It talks about all different kinds of cultures. The book, I would say, is anti-racist. It's not a book that, I mean, there are some opinions in here that you may not agree with, but the overall tone of the book is one of, let's look at things from a global perspective and let's see how we can understand one another and so forth. So I think if people read the book and actually think about it, they would have a very positive reaction to it. The only negative reactions that I've gotten from people are people that have already had these preconceived notions in their mind. So that's what I'm trying to fight against.
Right. What sort of general reader feedback are you getting? Is it mostly positive?
It's mostly positive. Sometimes I get into a discussion with people before they buy the book, and these are topics that they're already interested in. They've had time to sit back, think about it for a while, And now some of these things are revisited, and it kind of refreshes their memory on it, and they kind of get to see things from another angle. And so it's quite an enjoyable read for most people.
Well, I certainly thought it was a great read. I class myself as, you know, reasonably knowledgeable, but I have to admit that I learned a few things from your book. You obviously spent a good deal of time researching it.
Right. This book, in a capsule, is pretty much my life almost. The things that I've walked on earth and experienced and heard. Like you say, when you start writing and putting things down, ideas just pour out of the subconsciouses of your mind, the deep recesses of your mind. It's really a catharsis. You get to really, you know, just put your life down in writing. And a lot of my ideas for the book, you know, you can watch a lot of TV, you can read a lot of books. And all of this information just soaks in. And when you get to put it down in writing, I've learned a lot of things myself just in writing this book. I think it has changed me for the better. I've kind of was initially maybe, you know, one that would take certain things lightly, even the N-word. And some things have happened in my life that have caused me to see that, hey, this is a word that probably needs to just die a quick death. And so just writing this material has softened me or has made me culturally aware of other cultures and how people see them and how I may have seen them. And I wanted to really change myself and say, okay, I'm not racist, but still, I mean, why do I think this about this certain race? Why do, you know, when I see an Asian person, do certain ideas pop up in my mind, you know? And nobody says in their mind that all Asian people know karate or all Asian people eat cats or dogs. But in the same sense, there are certain things that kind of focus around your mind that lend themselves to those stereotypes, and that's what I want people to see.
Well, one of the most common forms of racism is ethnic jokes. What I find interesting is that, you know, you can travel the world and the jokes stay exactly the same. Only the races involved change. Has that been your experience?
Pretty much. I mean, people out there may have heard the jokes of a white man, a black man, a Chinese man go this place and something happens and it's focused around the stereotypical leanings of the one race. I mean, it's just like you said, just interchange the people. A white man, a black man, a Polish person, and so forth. And it's just all just the same formula. And that's why in the book I have a part titled The Methods of Racists and What They Do, and it's broken down into five things. And it's pretty much just a formulaic rendition. You know, one of the things is that they combine two slurs to denote that the two races are combined, and they, you know, instead of celebrating multiculturalism, they try to pick at it. They add a descriptor to the N-word, a coon, a monkey, to make a slur more offensive. They add a descriptor to the word head to make fun of someone. They call someone by a stereotypical name to represent the entire race. Or they take a famous person or an infamous person and apply this to the same race. So with these jokes, it's pretty much the same thing. They just, like you said, just change the characters around.
Oh, absolutely. You mentioned it, that there's one word in our American vocabulary that causes more controversy than almost anything I can name, the N-word. You know, what is the story here? Why is it seemingly sociably acceptable for black youth to use it? In fact, it is often used almost as a term of endearment. But God forbid a white guy should say it. You know, careers have been lost. Mark Furman, not that I'm any great fan of Mark Furman, but, you know, his experience in the first O.J. Simpson trial can attest to that one. What is it with this infamous N-word?
Well, let's just break it down from the very beginning. The word had its origins in something very innocent, a word just meaning black, Latin word. Then it morphed into the N-word, and then it became used to tear people down of darker skin. And so this is a history behind this word, and it just seems like a lot of black people have tried to co-opt this word to try to soften the sting of it, as you say, to use it as a term of endearment. But it's just the old adage that they're trying to laugh to keep from crying, because no matter what, no matter how you use this word in your own life, if you're African American, the minute, like you said, that a person of another race calls you that name, it automatically turns into something very ugly. So the whole idea that I put forth in the book is that, you know, this word should not be used widely by anyone, because it's such a hurtful word, and it can never be made positive. And just it's just the history behind it, you know, it's just so nasty. It's just not really a place in the English language, except if you're educating someone about it or talking about it in an educational sense to tell people that it's a bad word, but just to be loosely using it in your conversation is a death trap, so to speak.
Well, one of the uses of it that absolutely appalls me is in rap music. I occasionally ride in my 19-year-old stepson's car, and I view it like entering a verbal battlefield. You know, racism and sexism abound in the music, and I can't see anything good that can come out of this. Also, the artists that use the term, and I use the term artist very loosely, seem to be projecting a lifestyle that's far from wholesome. A rapper's success almost seems to be linked directly to the severity of the crimes he's committed. You know, a good murder pretty much guarantees a number one hit. Yeah,
right.
There's something wrong here.
Right, that's exactly right. I don't know if you know anything about the history of rap music or hip-hop, but when it first started, it was something that was positive, that was used to keep kids off the street. There was a culture involved, and you didn't hear a bunch of cursing involved. There were live instruments. There was, you know, not a lot of talking about killing, violence, you know, mishandling women. And so what happened was the corporate world got involved, and now all of a sudden you hear all this garbage coming out. And it's been a backlash from even within the hip-hop industry from some of the pioneers. But the sad part about it is that, you know, they think that they're doing something that's going to make them money, but it's really just hurting themselves and hurting their whole culture. I mean, if you just listen to some of the lyrics, it's even hard to just listen to it, because, you know, you can sort of see their mindset and why this word is so dangerous, because they're saying the N-word, but at the same time they're showing that they have hatred toward themselves and others. And so this is the kind of the same idea that white supremacists use behind the N-word, and they're co-opting that for themselves, and it's really just atrocious.
Oh, it's horrible. I'm a big fan of history, and I'm actually a firm believer that by understanding the past, we can better understand the present, and maybe even better predict the future. So I'm going to give you a history lesson, although you may already know this.
Okay.
In the heyday of vaudeville, the late 1800s, a common act was a white guy would dress up to make himself look like a black man. In fact, for many years in Britain, where I grew up, there was actually a radio and then TV show called The Black and White Minstrel Show. And, you know, this was absolutely socially acceptable. In fact, the original vaudeville acts were the catalyst for a very common children's soft toy, the gollywog. It was essentially usually a male effigy soft toy with a black head and spiky black hair. In fact, so popular was this toy that it became the emblem of the Robertson's Jam and Preserve Company. And they're a huge, huge, you know, jam and marmalade company based in England. And each one of their jars would have a little paper gollywog behind the label of on the jar. And you could collect these things, just like coupons, and redeem them for prizes. Then suddenly everything changed. In the early 60s, people started to use the term gollywog and then shortened it to just wog as a derogatory description of black people. Robinson's dropped the gollywog like a hot brick, and to the best of my knowledge, no one makes that little plush toy anymore. You know, I'm hopeful that maybe the N-word will go the way of the gollywog. You know, it's up to society to fight back, to react and say, this is not right. We need to stop this. But I don't know how.
Right. That's the thing. It has to be such an uproar, not just in the black community, the white community, but the global community, that this word is causing enough trouble. It's going to be archaic, refined to the dictionary under the archaic definition. But, you know, like you said, that it has to be such an uproar. But when you got people using it in songs and just kind of playing around with the idea, and comedians, you know, just people. And the whole thing really behind this is, I'm pretty sure, this is one question I get asked quite often, can black people be racist? And the idea behind that is that if you're a minority, you're not in a position to really affect anyone. You can't really discriminate as far as jobs, and you don't have the power structure set up. So that was the original idea behind why black people couldn't be racist, because their just power wasn't there. But that causes laziness. It causes a victim mentality, and what it does is you allow yourself to think that I can do this, I can do that, but you better not do this. And so with the N-word, you've allowed yourself to say, I can use, you know, we know that generally, in a general sense, it's not as offensive for one race to pick on themselves. That's just human nature. It's, you know, whatever slurs you have for English people, if you use it to refer to yourself or refer to your fellow Englishmen, it's not going to be as offensive as me using it or somebody else. We know that. But in the same sense, this word is at the pinnacle of slurs. It can get no worse. They cannot create another slur that will top the N-word. So this slur needs to be handled as an example of what other slurs need to go, you know, out the window. And so people need to treat this word differently than other slurs because it is different. And that's just my take on it.
Have you yourself been a victim of racism?
Actually, I have. Sometimes we have the tendency to look at things a certain way, and some people just automatically say, oh, that's racism, that's racist. Where, in a sense, now after writing this book, I'm becoming more aware of institutionalized racism, which is harder to detect. But there have been situations, I'll just give you a brief example. As a teacher, you have to go through the teacher preparation course, and I was sent out to a place that's in a more well-to-do area, and As soon as I went there, I had reservations. Here it is, I'm an African-American male. When you go into the school, you don't really see any other African-American males. The only other African-Americans you see are maybe one or two female teachers and the janitors. And so here it is, I'm in a trailblazing position. And so I was like, okay, this can go either way. And so when I got there, you know, I was a little tentative. I didn't really, you know, I was trying to warm up to the place. And so the teacher that I was, you know, that was over me, you know, I would come in and every now and then she would ask me to do something. Whatever she asked me to do, I would do it gladly. But it got to the point where this teacher went to the college and was telling them that, you know, I was coming in there and not really wanting to do things and stuff like that instead of coming to me first. And they didn't do all of this until I had complained to the college that I didn't feel comfortable there. That was almost like their response to that.
Right, so action, was, reaction.
Yeah, it was like a whole bunch of lies that they just tacked on to it. And I guess their whole thing was, you know, it's my word versus his word. I'm pretty sure they'll believe me. And so I had a heart-to-heart with the college, and they just moved me somewhere else. And so, you know, sometimes this racism is a form of, you know, this is who I am. They'll believe me more than they'll believe you because this is who you are. And so you can ask yourself, is that racism or is that classism? You know, what is it?
Yeah. I mean, there's, before we came on air, you were saying that you wanted to talk about some of the recent occurrences.
Right. Let's just take, there was an incident, I'm not sure if you're aware of it, Toby Keith. Are you aware of him?
Oh, yes, I know who Toby is.
Right. He was involved recently in a controversy where it was shown that he was slanting his eyes in reference to Asians. Now, this is something that I write about in the book, and it seems to be something that people need to be educated on, that slanting your eyes is really a racist type of gesture. A lot of Caucasians seem to think that this is, you know, innocent. I've written in the book about Miley Cyrus. She got in trouble for that. Amy Winehouse, she got in trouble for being on a video talking about gooks, nips, and packies. I've also have in here Joe Jonas. He was caught doing the same thing. And so I just want people to know that it's not just a white and black thing. It's also other races involved, and they're sensitive to these things as well. The Asian community. Every time something like this happens, there's Asian organizations that, you know, have an uproar about this because it's not just black and white, it's other races too. And so that was one incident that happened recently that, you know, I wanted to talk about, as well as there's another incident about the Connecticut firemen. Are you aware of that situation?
Not sure. I may have read about it.
Sonia Sotomayor.
Oh, yes.
Yes, it was a big to-do when she was going to, for confirmation, they paraded these people in and they kind of talked bad about her. Well, they finally did get their promotion, and I speak about that in the book as well. So there's a lot of stuff in here that are, even when you read it, you can see things still developing. And so if you're not aware of these things, this book can be a quick launching pad to get you up to date, so to speak, because even I talk about Kanye West and Taylor Swift in the book, and that chapter has still not been written. If you look, the Grammys are coming up. There's going to be a big you know, controversy as to who gets this award, who gets that award, and then there was a situation where people were saying Kanye West was snubbed because of his actions. So there's a lot of stuff still going on in the book that you can apply today.
Right. Do you have a website?
Yes. My official website for the book is www.plaintalk2010.com, and that's the official website where you can take a look at an excerpt I'm also on various websites like Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, BooksAMillion.com, and a host of other online websites as well.
Yep, and for our listeners, you can also just do a search on Google, and I'm pretty certain you'll find my review somewhere on the front page, and I have a link to Amazon and also a link to Corey's homepage. And so you've got lots of opportunities to buy this very insightful book.
I just got on Kindle, Amazon.com. If you have a Kindle, you can actually download it to your Kindle now.
Yeah. You know, I get a lot of books for review in PDF and electronic formats, and I've been trying really hard to get me a review Kindle, but
yeah.
Amazon just don't seem to want to send me one.
Okay.
Are you working on another book?
Yes, actually. Every time I say that this is volume one, everybody assumes, oh, you got two more coming. Well, actually, I'm working on number two right now, and the writing's been kind of slow because of the promotion of this first book, but this title is tentatively titled Digging a Little Deeper, because I kind of want to get into some more specifics on things and really get into things. I've been doing a lot of reading and seeing what other people have to say about the subject of race, because to be honest, this first book, I didn't want it muddied by anybody else's what they think. This first book is purely me, my life, putting it on the pages. I didn't do a lot of reading about other people right before I wrote the book, but this second book, I'm digging a little deeper and critically looking at what other people say. And also we're going to touch on some topics, but I'm still going to call the book Plain Talk, because I think that an essential part of talking about race is making it plain and simple and not trying to be too complex with all of these rubbish theories on the, you know, superiority of this race over that race. And, I mean, it's just things that can really distract people.
I think you took a good line by not looking at what other people say. In fact, I'm not a writer in that I write books. I am, however, a writer in that I write reviews. And I never, ever, ever look at anyone else's review. I read the book, I write what I think, and then I go look, you know, just to see what everyone else has to say. But I always do it after the fact.
Right. That's a good thing, because you don't realize how much you can be influenced subconsciously by what other people have written or so forth.
Right. Corey, alas, our time is up. I really want to thank you for taking time out to talk to us today, and I want to wish you every success with Plain Talk, Volume 1, and I'm personally looking forward to Volume 2, and I like the idea that, you know, you want to dig deeper. Volume 1 is fine, but it really only does scratch the surface. I think there's a great deal more to be told.
Right. I didn't want to hit people with too much information, because one of the problems I've had with many books written on race is I'm flipping through kind of saying, this is garbage. I need to go through and find the meat and really what this person is saying. And so I didn't want people to do that with my book, so I decided to make them, you know, a little shorter and break it down into sections. And if you want, you can go back and revisit, you know, certain volumes. But I didn't want the people to become bogged down in just, you know, extra stuff. I want to get right into what I'm saying.
Corey, thank you so much for talking with us this morning. This is Simon Barrett for Blogger News Network, wishing everyone a great Saturday, and I'm sure we'll be back again soon. Goodbye.